From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Florinda by Seamus Fraser. "Did you and Miss Reeve have a lovely walk, darling?" Claire asked of the child, in the tarnished depths of glass before her. "Well, it was lovely for me, but not for Miss Reeve, because she tore her stocking on a bramble and it bled."
"The stocking?"
"No."
"That ran a beautiful ladder," said Jane very solemnly, "but there were two long tears on her leg, as if a cat had scratched her. We were going along by the path by the lake when the brambles caught her. She almost fell in. She did look funny, Mommy, hopping on the bank like a hen blackbird a cat's playing with and squawking. Poor Miss Reeve. Your father's going to have that path cleared soon. It's quite overgrown."
"Oh, I hope not soon, Mommy. I love the brambly places. And what the birds and rabbits will do if they're cut down, I can't imagine. The thickety bushes are all hopping and fluttering with them when you walk, and the path wiggles as if it were living, too. So you must lift your feet high and stamp on it, the way Florinda does."
But Claire was not listening anymore. She had withdrawn her glance from Jane's grave elfin features in the shallowed recesses of the glass to fix it on her own image, spread as elegantly upon its surface as a swan.
"And if Daddy has the bushes cut down," Jane went on, "what will poor Florinda do? Where will she play? There will be no place at all for the little traps and snares she sets. No place for her to creep and whistle in and tinkle into laughter when something funny happens, like Miss Reeve caught by the leg and hopping." This was the time, when her mother was not listening, that Jane could talk most easily about Florinda. She looked at her mother's image wrapped in the dull mysteries of grown-up thought within the oval Chippendale glass, and thence to the rococo frame of gilded wood, in whose interlacing design two birds of faded gilt, a bat with a chipped wing and flowers, whose golden petals and leaves showed here and there little spots and tips of white plaster like a disease, were all caught forever. "That's how I met Florinda," she was chattering quite confidently, now that she knew that it was only to herself. "I've been down to the edge of the lake, where there are no brambles, you know, the lawn side, and I knelt down to look at myself in the water, and there were two of me. That's what I thought at first, two of me, and then I saw one was someone else. It was Florinda, smiling at me, but I couldn't smile back, not for anything. There we were, like you and me in the glass, one smiling and one very solemn. Then Miss Reeve called and Florinda just went, and my face was alone and astonished in the water. She's shy, Florinda is, and sly, too. Shy and sly, that's Florinda for you." The repeated name stirred Claire to a vague consciousness. She had heard it on Jane's lips before.
"Who is Florinda?" she asked.
"Mummy, I've told you. She's a doll, I think, only large, large as me, and she never talks, not with words anyway, and her eyes can't shut, even when she lies down."
"I thought she was called Arabella."
"That's the doll Uncle Richard gave me last Christmas. Arabella does close her eyes when she lies down, and she says good night, Mama, too, because of the gramophone record inside her. But Florinda's different. She's not a house doll. She belongs outside, though I have asked her to come to tea on Christmas Eve."
"Well, darling, I've lots of letters to write, so just you run along to the nursery and have a lovely tea." So Florinda was a doll, an ideal doll, it seemed, that Jane had invented in anticipation of Christmas. 9 in the new year, Jane was growing perhaps a little old for dolls. A strange child, thought Claire, difficult to understand, and that she took after her mother, though in looks it was her father she resembled. With a sigh, Claire slid out the drawer of the mahogany writing desk. She distributed writing paper and envelopes, the Christmas cards, reproductions of Alcon prints, in neat piles over the red leather, and opening her address book, set herself to write. Roger came in with the early December dusk. He had been tramping around the estate with Wakefield the agent, and the cold had painted his cheeks blue and nipped his nose red so that he looked like a large, clumsy gnome. He kissed Claire on the nape, and the icy touch of his nose spread goose flesh over her shoulders. "You go and pour yourself some whiskey," she said, "and thaw yourself out by the fire. I'll be with you in a minute." She addressed two more envelopes in her large, clear hand, and then, without looking around, said, "Have we bitten off rather more than we can chew?" "There's an awful lot to be done," said her husband from the fire. "So much one hardly knows where to begin. The woods are a shambles. Neeson Hut's nastiness and barbed wire. One would have thought Uncle Eustace would have made some effort to clear up the mess after the army moved out. But, darling, he never came back to live here. He was too wise, too ill and too old, and he never gave thought to those who'd inherit the place, I suppose. He never thought we'd be foolish enough to come and live here anyway." Roger's uncle had died in a nursing home in Bournemouth earlier in the year, and Roger had come into these acres of Darkshire park and woodland, and the somber peeling house, Fowling Hall, sat among them. At Claire's urging, he had tried to sell the place, but there were no offers, and now Roger had the obstinate notion of settling here and trying to make pigs and chickens pay for the upkeep of the estate. Of course, Claire knew. There was something else behind his recent interest in the country life. Nothing had been said, but she knew what Roger wanted, and she knew, too, that he would hint at it again before long. The forbidden subject. She stacked her letters on the desk and went to join him by the fire. "There's one thing you can do," she said. "Clear that path that goes round the lake. Poor Miss Reeve tore herself quite nastily on a bramble this afternoon, walking there. I'll remind Wakefield to get the men on the job tomorrow. And what was Jane doing down by the lake just now as I came in? I called her and she ran off into the bushes." "My dear, Jane's been up in the nursery for the last hour or more. Miss Reeve's reading to her. You know she's not allowed out this raw weather except when the sun's up. The doctor said." "Well, I wondered. I only glimpsed her, a little girl, in the dusk. She ran off when I called." "One of the workmen's children, I expect?" "Perhaps. Strange, I didn't think of that." He took a gulp of whiskey and changed the subject. "Claire, it's going to cost the earth to put this place properly in order. It would be worth it if he added with an effort, "I mean, if one thought it was leading anywhere." So it had come out, the first hint. "You mean if we had a son, don't you? Don't you, Roger?" She spoke accusingly. "I merely meant, well, yes, though, of course." She didn't let him finish. "But you know what the doctor said after Jane. You know how delicate she is. You can't want..." "If she had a brother," Roger began. Claire laughed, a sudden shiver of laughter, and held her hands to the fire. "Roger, what an open hypocrite you are. If she had a brother, when all the time you mean if I had a son. And how could you be certain it wouldn't be a sister? No, Roger, we've had this out 1,000 times in the past. It can't be done." She shook her head and blinked at the fire. "It would work out." Roger went into the nursery, as was his too irregular custom, to say good night to Jane. She was in her pink fleecy dressing gown, slippered toes resting on the wire fender, a bowl emptied of bread and milk on her knees. Miss Reeve was reading her story about a princess who was turned by enchantment into a fox. "Don't let me interrupt, Miss Reeve. I'll look in again later." "Oh, do come in, Mr. Whaley. We're almost ready for bed. I was sorry to hear about your accident this afternoon. It was such a silly thing, really. I caught my foot in a slip noose of bramble. It was as if somebody had set it on the path on purpose, only that would be too ridiculous for words. But it was a shock, and I tore myself painfully trying to get free." There was still the ghost of that panic, Roger noticed, in Miss Reeve's pasty, pudgy features and signaling behind the round lenses of her spectacles. "It's not a very nice path for a walk," she added, "but one can't keep Jane away from the lake." "I'm having all the undergrowth cleared away from the bank," said Roger. "That should make it easier walking." "Oh, that'll be ever so much nicer, Mr. Whaley." "Florinda won't like it," thought Jane, sitting stiffly in her wicker chair by the fire. "She won't like it at all. She'll be in a wicked temper, will Florinda." But she said aloud in a voice of small protest, for what was the use of speaking about Florinda to grown-ups? "It won't be nice at all. It'll be quite horribly beastly." The men didn't care for the work they had been set to do. It was the skeletons, they said, and they prodded suspiciously with their implements at the little lumps of bone and feather and fur that their cutting and scything had revealed. "There was a killer somewhere in the woods, owls," said one. "Stoats," said another. But old Renshaw said glumly it was neither bird nor beast that it was. Something that walked that shouldn't. And this infected the others with a derisive disquiet. All the same, 50 yards of path were cleared during the morning, which took them beyond the small Doric pavilion that once served as boathouse, and was reflected by a stone twin housing, the lock mechanism, on the eastern side of the lake. Miss Reeve took Jane out in the afternoon to watch the men's progress. Jane ran ahead down the cleared path, paused at the pavilion to hang over the flaking balustrade and gaze down into the water, whispered something, shook her head, and ran on. "Hello, Mr. Renshaw." "Alone?" she cried, as rounding a sudden twist in the path, she came upon the old man hacking at the undergrowth. Renshaw started and cut short, and the blade bit into his foot. This accident stopped work for the day. "It wasn't right, Miss Jane, to come on me like that," he said, as they were helping him up the house. "You gave me a real turn, I thought." "I know," said Jane, fixing him with her serious, puzzled eyes. And she was there, too, watching all the time. Whatever the killer was, it moved its hunting ground that night. 2 white Orpingtons were found dead beside the arks next morning, their feathers scattered like snow over the bare ground. "And it's not an animal, neither," said Ron, the boy who carried the mash into the runs and had discovered the kill. "What do you mean, it's not an animal?" asked Wakefield. "I mean that their necks is run, Mr. Wakefield." "Oh, get away," said Wakefield. But the following morning, another hen was found lying in a mess of feathers and blood, and Wakefield reported to his master. "It can't be a fox, sir. That head's not been bitten off. It's been pulled off, sir. And there was this, sir, was found by the arks. It was a child's bracelet of black and silver." The path was cleared, but on the farther side of the lake, the shrubberies that melted imperceptibly into the tall woods bordered it closely. Here Jane dawdled on her afternoon walk. At the bend in the path near the boathouse, she waited until her governess was out of sight, and then called softly into the gloom of yew and rhododendrons and laurel. "I think you're a beast, and I'm not going to be your friend any more. Do you hear? And you're not to come on Christmas Eve, even if you're starving." There was a movement in the shadows, and she glimpsed the staring blue eyes and pinched face, and the tattered satin finery. "And it's no use following us, so there!" Jane stuck her tongue out as a gesture of defiance and ran away along the path. "Are you all right?" asked Miss Reeve, who had turned back to look for her. "I thought I heard someone crying." "Oh, it's only Florinda," said Jane, "and she can sob her eyes out now for all I care." "Jane," said Miss Reeve severely, "how many more times have I to tell you Florinda is a naughty fib, and we shouldn't tell naughty fibs, even in fun?" "It's no fun," said Jane, so low that Miss Reeve could hardly catch a word. "No fun at all being Florinda." A hard frost set in overnight. It made a moon landscape of the park and woods, and engraved on the nursery window panes, sharply as with a diamond, intricate traceries of silver fern. The bark of the trees was patterned with frost like chainmail, and from the gaunt branches icicle daggers glinted in the sun. Each twig of the bare shrubs had budded its teardrops of ice. The surface of the lake was wrinkled and gray like the face of an old woman, and Wakefield says if it keeps up, we may be able to skate on it on Boxing Day. But by midday the temperature rose, and all out of doors was filled with a mournful pattering and dripping. Towards evening a dirty yellow glow showed in the sky, and furry black clouds moved up over the woods bringing snow. It snowed after that for 2 days, and then it was Christmas Eve. You look like the Snow Queen, but you smell like the Queen of Sheba. Must you go out tonight, Mummy? Darling, it's a bore. We promised Lady Graves, so we have to. But you should have kept your fingers crossed. But you'll be back soon? In time to catch Father Christmas climbing down the chimneys, I expect. But earlier than that, promise. Much earlier than that. Daddy wants to get back early anyway. He and Wakefield had a tiring night sitting up with a gun to guard their precious hens. But she... It never came, did it? Not last night. And now you go to lovely sleeps, and when you wake, perhaps Father Christmas will have brought you Florinda in his...
No! Cried the child. Not Florinda! Mummy, please!
What a funny thing you are, said Claire, stooping to kiss her. You were quite silly about her a few days ago. Jane shivered and snuggled down in the warm bed. I've changed, she said. We're not friends anymore. After the lights were out, Jane imagined she was walking in the snow. The snowflakes fell as lightly as kisses, and soon they had covered her with a white soft down. Now she knew herself to be a swan, and she tucked her head under a wing, and so fell asleep on the dark rocking water. But in the next room, Miss Reeve, who had gone to bed early, could not sleep because of the wind that sobbed so disquietingly around the angles of the house. At last, she put out a hand to the bedside table, poured herself water, groped for the aspirin bottle, and swallowed down 3 tablets at a gulp. It was as she rescrewed the top. She noticed it was not the aspirin bottle she was holding. She could have sworn that the sleeping tablets had been in her dressing table drawer. Her first thought was that someone had changed the bottles on purpose, but that, she told herself, would be too absurd. There was nothing she could do about it. The crying of the wind mounted to a shrill, broken fluting that sounded oddly like children's laughter. The first thing they noticed when the car drew up, its chained tires grinding and clanking under the dark porch, was that the front door was ajar. "Wait here," said Roger to the chauffeur. "There seems to have been visitors while we were away." Claire switched on the drawing room lights and screamed at the demonic havoc they revealed. The chairs and tables overturned, the carpet a litter of broken porcelain, feathers from the torn cushions and melting snow. Someone had thrown the heavy silver inkwell at the wall glass, which hung askew, its surface cracked and starred, and the delicate frame broken. "No sane person," Roger began, but already Claire was running up the stairs to the nursery and screaming, "Jane! Jane!" as she ran. The nursery was wrecked too. The sheets clawed in strips, the floor adrift of feathers from the ripped pillows. Only the doll Arabella with a shattered head was propped up in the empty bed. When Claire touched her, she fell backwards and began to repeat, "Good night, Mama," as a mechanism inside her worked. They found Jane's footsteps in the snow leading over the lawn in the direction of the lake. Once they thought they saw her ahead of them, but it was only the snowman Roger had helped her build during the afternoon. There was a misty moon, and by its light they followed the small, naked footprints to the edge of the lake, but their eyes could make out nothing beyond the snow-fringed ice. Roger had sent on the chauffeur to abandon the drive where the car's headlights could illuminate the further bank. And now, in the sudden glare they saw in the dark center of the ice, the two small figures, Jane in her nightdress and beside her a little girl in an old-fashioned blue satin, who walked oddly and jerkily, lifting her feet and stamping them on the ice. They called together, "Jane! Jane! Come back!" She seemed to have heard, and she turned, groping towards the light. The other caught at her arm, and the two struggled together on the black, glassy surface. Then, from the stars, it seemed, and into their cold hearts, fell a sound like the snapping of a giant lute string. The two tiny interlocked figures had disappeared, and the ice moaned and tinkled at the edges of the lake. Rowena Ballantyne by Adele Jarris. Have you ever wondered what brings a ghost back to a certain place at a particular time? I never used to, but I've been thinking about this ever since I summoned Rowena Ballantyne back from the dead to haunt the quarters of her old boarding school. I did it without meaning to. I found Rowena's rough book under a loose, squeaky floorboard in the bedroom I share with 2 other girls. I'm nosy, and one day I nearly tripped up on this bit of wood as I was on my way back from my bed to my cupboard. I lifted it up, and there was the book, exactly like the ones we still use for making notes about homework and so forth, only with a royal blue cover instead of a red one. The pages were all curled up and dusty at the edges, so I knew at once it had been lying buried for years and years, and sure enough there was the date on the first page, 1962. I opened it. Wouldn't you have done the same thing? And as I began to read, I could almost feel Rowena taking shape in the air, though of course I didn't see her until some time later. But I'm plunging straight into the narrative without any kind of introduction. Miss Baldstone, our English teacher, would not approve. Stories should have, she says, a beginning, middle, and end. And I think finding the rough book is probably the middle. Let me start again. My name is Vanessa. I'm 13 years old, and I go to school in a traditional boarding school for girls. There are still some around outside the pages of an Enid Blyton book for children of parents who aren't short on a pound or two. But we have all the problems you'd find in a comprehensive, and we also have all sorts coming here. There are sporty types, fashion victims, jolly bouncy sorts and swats, which I suppose is what I am. We have the same posters up on our walls and admire the same footballers and pop stars. The school is called Staghurst College. I've just moved into the senior school. We live in four different houses, and mine is Nelson. The others are Wellington, Churchill, and Raleigh. Prefects have studies, and the rest of us make do with a common room. We sleep in bedrooms, not dormitories, and we can choose to share with one, two, or three girls. Some of our customs and pastimes are quaint. For example, one of the things that happens quite a lot is this. People are invited in from the outside world to talk to us and tell us about their fascinating lives, etc. We call these talks lectures, and what we do is we all troop into the hall. We listen if the talk is interesting and daydream if it isn't. One poor soul, though, always has to pay attention, and that is the unfortunate creature who's been chosen to give the vote of thanks. The list of lectures goes up at the beginning of term, and it's easy to spot the ones that are just careers advice in disguise. 10 things you never knew about merchant banking. My happy days as a veterinary nurse. You know, the sort of thing I mean. I've noticed Jemima Westman's lecture at once, helping young offenders the gentle way, because I want to be a social worker when I leave school, or an investigative journalist. I think I'd be good at that, because I'm nosy, as I said, and I also like helping people. I suppose being an agony aunt would be fun. I'm getting carried away. Miss Baldstone would be scribbling in the margin like mad by now if I were to hand this in. She often writes things like irrelevant beside my work. I'm not sure if all this is irrelevant or not, but surely you have to know a little about what sort of person I am before you believe me, right? I'm honest, then, and curious and kind-hearted. I found Rowena's rough book in October. It was nearly time to go down to prep, and I put it straight into my sack, another quaint custom. We don't have school bags, but large canvas sacks to carry our stuff around in. Something I'm not sure what told me to say nothing about the book to anyone. There was a musty smell on the pages, and I felt like some kind of archaeologist, even though in 1962 isn't a very long time ago. I decided to read it during prep. We all sit at desks, and there's a prefect sitting in the front to make sure we're all silent and getting on with our work. I waited till I was certain that Jackie and Hetty on either side of me were lost in the wonders of quadratic equations, and then I started to read. Rowena had spiky writing, and she wrote in black fountain pen, which is not surprising. It's just one other strange thing at this school. Many of the older teachers who won't hear of you doing any work in biro, they say it ruins the handwriting. The letters had faded to a sort of brown, and they were quite hard to make out sometimes. But I managed to read what there was. It wasn't very much. Most of the pages didn't have anything more thrilling on them than things like geography, glaciated valleys, page 35. But there were some near the end which made me shiver, and I felt it run down my spine. Reading those, I felt I knew what she was feeling. I was bringing her to a kind of life. That sounds ridiculous, I know, but as Miss Baldstone is forever pointing out, words are powerful. They can hurt and move and startle and make you laugh and cry. That is why you have to be so careful about which ones you choose. I don't think Rowena was worried about fine writing. It was more as though she were using the pages as a shoulder to cry on. That's the only way I can put it. Here are some of the things she wrote. They hate me. They all do. I wish I could disappear, just walk away and never come back. They stare at me. JW is the worst. She says only witches have red hair like mine. So am I a witch? And when I said no, she turned to Babs and said, "We don't want fat, red-headed witches in our gang, do we?" And they both had hysterics. After they'd gone, I started crying, and then I was late for physics because I had to wait in the cloakroom for ages afterwards till my eyes stopped being red. My eyes were all right when I went in, but my whole body hurt from being sad, and they all looked at me, and Jay and Babs especially smirked, and when I went to sit down, they sort of moved up the bench and pulled all their stuff away so that it shouldn't touch any of my stuff. I pushed down all the tears, but later in bed, I cried so much that my pillow was wet and I had to turn it over. Later on, she wrote, "M and D spend tons of money to send me here. I wish I could tell them I want to leave, but they'd be disappointed. D likes boasting about me being here. I wish I could do better. I'm good at swimming, but changing is awful." They all laugh. "Fat, fat," they say, "and wobbly. JW is so thin. She's always going on about being a witch, and will I turn her into a frog?" More hysterical laughter. Every night when I go to bed, I wish the morning would never come. I hate it here. I hate myself. The last entry in the book was, "I decided what to do. It's easy, and I don't know why I haven't thought of it before. Who'd care? No one, that's who. M&D, baby. But they've got Sheila and Donald to cheer them up. Everyone else will be glad to be rid of me. Me, more than anyone else. I just wish it was all finished, all over. Well, it soon will be. I'm never going to cry again." Even though it was warm in the prep room, I shivered. It was as though Rowena had been whispering in my ear and I could hear the full misery of her voice. She meant to kill herself, but did she do it? Who could I ask? Even though our teachers were old, they didn't go back that far, surely. Also, if Rowena had committed suicide, they wouldn't be in a hurry to tell anyone. Death isn't the kind of thing you want on your prospectus if you're a posh girl school. I decided to think about it. I hid Rowena's rough book in my pajama case, which was a babyish fluffy cat thingy I've had since I was a junior. I began to dream about Rowena Ballantyne every night, wandering through the corridors, and then one day I saw her. We were all in chapel. I caught sight of someone in the choir standing at the far left of the second row. I recognized her at once. She was a big girl, and you could see why some people, horrible Jay, would call her fat. But she wasn't really, just big and healthy-looking, with a wide, pale, freckled face that should have been smiling and wasn't. And the hair. There wasn't anyone I knew in school who had hair like that. Bright, clear red that glittered as though each strand was touched with gold. Red, red that could not have come from any bottle, but which flared like a lit torch in the dimness of the choir gallery. "Who's that?" I asked Jackie. "Up there next to Valerie Smythe in the second row." Jackie looked at me as though I'd taken leave of my senses. "There's no one standing next to Val. She's on the end of the row." I looked again, and Rowena had disappeared. That was the first sighting. I thought of the notebook and how I had opened it and read it, and this is how I put it to myself. Brought the ghost of Rowena back to where she had been so unhappy. I felt guilty. I'd wish I'd never lifted that dratted floorboard. What I had done, I felt, was condemn her to wander through this place that she loathed for all time. I wondered if one could talk to a ghost. And if you could, would it listen? There was also the possibility, the distinct possibility, that the whole thing was in my head. I could have been imagining it. But then I saw her over and over again, running up from the playing fields at the end of games, in a crowd of people, her hair streaming behind her like a banner, in the back row of the prep room, peering at me from behind a desk, and also quite often hanging about outside study two on the prefect's corridor, almost as though she were looking for someone. Every so often I asked one of my friends if they could see her, and they never could. They didn't know about her rough book because I'd kept it secret, so I suppose it wasn't surprising that they began to think I was mad, in a jokey way, of course. The days and weeks went by, and one Sunday in November, there we all were in their chairs in the hall, ready to listen to Jemima Westman talking about her brilliant career as a social worker. The first surprise was how glamorous she was, even though she was old, at least 50, I should think. The second surprise was she was an old girl. I'm sure no one had ever told me that, so it came as a bit of a shock when she mentioned that she'd been in Nelson House. And when I was a prefect, I had studied too. I've just been down to have a look at it, and it's made me feel very strange. Is the things that happened to me while I was at Staghurst, things that I did which led directly to my work with teenagers. I'm concerned with the fact that so many have such low self-esteem and put up with dreadful things like bullying, which no one should ever have to cope with at any age. My job is to try and help them as much as I can. Jemima Westman looked down and blushed. I have, she said, a confession to make. I've never told anyone this before, but now that I'm here in the old school hall, I feel as though there are certain people looking at me and listening, and I'd like to apologize publicly for something I did, or rather for something I didn't do. She gazed all around the hall, and suddenly her mouth fell open, and her skin turned the color of pale cheese. She took a mouthful of water from the glass on the table beside her and looked towards the back of the hall again. I glanced at the place I thought she was looking at, and I think I knew even before I saw her that Rowena would be there sitting on a chair at the back. Jemima Westman had seen her too. I was sure of it. Jemima Westman, J.W. Was she the J.W. of the rough book? My heart began to beat fast, and I decided that I would ask her when the time came for questions. Did you ever know a red-headed girl called Rowena Ballantyne? I would say. I was trembling all over at the thought of saying it out loud in front of everyone like that, but I needed to know. I thought I knew now why Rowena had been wandering all around the school. She'd been looking for her, for J.W., her tormentor, and now she'd found her. Up on the stage, Jemima Westman was speaking again. She was still pale, but quite composed now, and she was addressing her words to the back of the hall. When I was 14, I was the leader of a gang. We were vile, conceited, arrogant, smug. We called ourselves the Beauties. Can you believe it? There was much polite laughter, and you could see the teachers looking at one another and thinking, this isn't terribly helpful for those of our girls who are anxious to be social workers. There was one girl in Nelson House who was not one of the Beauties. Her name was Rowena Ballantyne, and she was completely ordinary except for her hair, which was like flames growing out of her head. Her hair was a wonder of nature, and we tortured her for it. Jemima had tears in her eyes. I could see them quite plainly from where I was sitting in the second row. She went on. She would have done anything we asked because she wanted to be in our gang. I wouldn't share her chocolates, and we wouldn't let her help us with our Latin homework, even though she was brilliant, and we told her that her hair was ugly and that she must be a witch because only witches had hair that color. By now, Jemima's voice had faded to a whisper. When we became prefects, we were allowed to invite younger girls to tea in our studies on Sundays. For weeks and weeks, no one invited Rowena. The list would go up on the notice board, and week after week, she was ignored. Then one day, I asked her to come to study tea, and I was horrible to her in front of everyone. Horrible in the way thin people are to those who are not so thin. No tea cakes for you, Rowena. You stick to fruit. Look, there's an apple here. She was found face down in the swimming pool next morning. She was a very good swimmer. It couldn't have been an accident. She just didn't want to live anymore, and we were the ones. I was the one who had driven her to it. I killed her. Jemima spoke in a whisper, and her eyes were filled with tears. Then she pulled herself together and said, I really didn't mean to mention this today, but coming back here has reminded me, and I feel I owe her this apology after all these years. She stared at the back of the hall. Rowena, I'm so sorry. It won't help you now, but I am sorry. Forgive me. She smiled and looked at us again. That's why I've spent my life trying to help young people. Because of Rowena, may she rest in peace. After that, the lecture went on, as you would have expected. And then Jemima Westman relaxed and told us all about her brilliant career and how we too could have one if we wanted one. I looked at the back of the hall. Rowena Ballantyne had gone. I never saw her ever again. I moved the rough book from my pajama case into the small locked box where I keep my treasures. Sometimes I take it out and looked at her spiky, faded, brownish words, still powerful after all this time. Rowena herself is, I think, I hope, resting in peace at last.